Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Leaked information from the military deal between the US and the Kurdistan regional government has caused Iraqi MPs to call the deal a violation of Iraqi sovereignty.
Women in post-coup Turkey have found themselves subject to increased incidences of attacks, forcing many to avoid the streets altogether.
The Israeli parliament has brought in controversial new legislation allowing impeachment on the grounds of incitement to violence, racism or support for terrorism.
Human rights group Amnesty International have called for an immediate investigation into civilian casualties caused by US-led airstrikes in Syria.
Human Rights Watch has called for an immediate halt to the practice of detaining child refugees in Greece.
And just how did the Mississippi Senate find itself haunted by a demon chipmunk?
Earlier this month, the United States of America signed a military memorandum of understanding with the Kurdistan Regional Government of KRG, the official ruling body of the predominantly Kurdish region of northern Iraq, commonly referred to as Iraqi Kurdistan. This week, according to information leaked to Iraqi media, it has transpired that as part of the agreement, the United States will be building 5 military bases in the region and providing training and arms to the Kurdish Peshmerga forces to aid their continual battle against Daesh forces. This revelation has not gone down well with several Iraqi MPs who have voiced concerns over the ability of the Kurdish regional government to now bypass the Iraqi government over issues relating to security and international military deals.
Dr. John McDonald is the director of the Scottish Global Forum and a lecturer in US politics at the University of Glasgow and joins us on the line now. John, with regards to the recently signed military memorandum, America say that this is in recognition of the ongoing fight against Daesh and the significant role that the Kurdish Peshmerga forces have played. Several Iraqi MPs have spoken out against the deal and called this unconstitutional and consider it to be a violation of the sovereignty of Iraq. Are these well-founded claims? Should the Iraqi MPs be worried about this US-KRG deal?
I think if you're looking at the situation dispassionately, yes. I think Iraqi politicians may well be correct. This may well violate the Iraqi constitution. Given that the deal between Erbil and Washington pertains to weapons. The wider issue is, of course, you know, why this has happened and I suppose very, very importantly, why Washington has chosen to sign this deal with Erbil, knowing that it's going to invoke backlash and perhaps some anger in Baghdad. It's one of these curious situations where I think we have to take into perspective everybody's viewpoint here, the viewpoint from Washington, the viewpoint from Erbil, and the viewpoint from Baghdad.
This week, leaked information from the deal suggests that the US are planning on building military bases in the region. Now, throughout March and April of this year, the US have provided military aid and equipment and funding to the Peshmerga forces. But is the creation of physical military bases a more worrying revelation, do you think?
Well, there are two ways you could look at that, Caroline. I mean, I think, firstly, the extension of the US tie with Iraqi Kurdistan is no surprise at all to anybody who's interested in the region. The key reason for this is, of course, that the US has invested an awful lot of blood and treasure in Iraq, for right or for wrong, of course. That's a different issue, perhaps. And that it does not want to see Iraq fail. And over the years, has consistently come to see the Peshmerga forces as the one reliable ally in the fight against ISIS. So this doesn't really come as any surprise, I don't think, that we're seeing a strengthening of military ties between the US and Iraqi Kurdistan at this point in time, regardless of the view from Baghdad, of course, which is underpinned by a different array of concerns. On the other hand, looking at the basing issue, if this were not simply about the fight against IS, many people would have concerns that we're seeing yet again the US expanding its network of bases across the world. Now, we don't quite know at this point what these bases are going to look like. It may well be that there will be a relatively minimal US presence there and that there will be Peshmerga bases. We don't quite know that yet. But as we know, many people have grave concerns about, as they see it, the expansion of America's military footprint across the globe. And there will be some who will view this move, regardless the fight against IS, with some caution.
And just finally, could this be seen as the US moving towards recognition of an independent Kurdistan? Is that something that we could see in the future?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I was out in Erbil in January, and you know, the place was abuzz amongst politicos about the prospect of an independence referendum, how manageable it would be, how it would be regarded in Baghdad. At that point in time, the US view, I think, was the official view was gently and politely, we don't think this is a good idea. Whether or not that has changed greatly, it remains to be seen. The US will continue to play a prudent line in that. The US priority at this point in time, it does not really revolve around Iraqi Kurdistan's constitutional future. The US interest revolves, first and foremost, about consolidating and strengthening the fight against IS. And the key players, the key support, the key allies they see in this fight are the Peshmerga. Hence this series of agreements about bases and military and financial support.
Thank you for joining us on the show today, John.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
As Turkey comes to grips with the aftermath of last week's failed coup attempt, reports are surfacing of increased hostility towards women in the country. A number of organisations have said that women have found themselves targeted in a growing number of misogynistic attacks, so much so that many are avoiding leaving their homes after dark.
Turkish society is already extremely male-dominated, with a military leadership that is entirely male, an 85% male government with just one female minister, and amongst the images of pro-government protests, women are notable by their absence. Incidents of sexual harassment have been on the rise since the attempted coup, such as women being threatened over the way they dress. Or, as one football executive, Veysel Taskin, posted on Twitter, quote, "The properties and the wives of the infidel coup-plotting bastards are spoils of war."
Joining me on the line now from Istanbul is the journalist Borjo Karakas. Thank you for speaking to us, Borjo. After last week, what's the situation in Turkey right now?
After the coup attempt was actually prevented, people started protesting on the streets, but I can add that most of them were from AKP. And so about the situation of women, while these protests were going on, and actually they are still going on at night, some women got harassed on the streets, you know, while they were walking home or while they were just going to their work in the morning, because also like in Ankara, there were also protests in the morning too.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, in general, of course, this woman issue is not something new for Turkey. There have been problems for so long. Me, honestly, I am not going out for these last days at night.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just trying to be home earlier, you know, like before it gets dark. And usually, of course, I don't do anything like this, like, but I don't want to be caught like in the middle of night mm-hmm. out. And also we started, you know, just to some of the women, I can say, I mean, not all of them, but like try to be a little bit concerned about our outfit, you know, like how should we, you know, like should I wear a skirt, like a short skirt while I'm going on the street? Cause someone may just get mad about that and just, you know, attack me and stuff. Because there have been some examples just like that.
It looks as though Erdogan in particular is making as much from the religious hard right as he can at the moment in terms of consolidating power. Are there parallels, would it be fair to say, with the likes of Iran in 1979, where obviously one of the most obvious casualties to that incoming regime was women's rights?
It is just too early to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But and I don't think that it is going, I mean, it is, you know, correct to make a comparison between Iran and Turkey right now. And especially Erdogan is going to hold a meeting today. I think it's going to happen in a couple of hours. And so he said that he's going to announce decision where like all the parties agreed, so we don't know what is that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we just have to wait and see, you know, what's going to happen about this woman issue. But it's just too early. But I mean, these harassments, they don't have anything to do with the government,
right?
You know, yeah. So we are just talking about the regular citizens, regular men.
So is this just more of an ingrained kind of misogynistic attitude then? Rather than
yes.
political opportunism.
Yes, exactly.
What sort of a support network is there in Turkey, if anything, to resist this sort of thing?
I think the only way, you know, to prevent this kind of things is the solidarity around women. But in general, right now, I mean, there is like no control, I can say, especially at night. You know, a group of people are just going on the streets. And of course, coup is something terrible, that's, which is also actually a reason why it didn't become successful, you know, because no one supports it so far. And like, I'm living in a secular era in Istanbul, we can say, mostly like votes for CHP. And I don't, I mean, I didn't hear from anyone saying that, you know, I wish the coup was successful. So this is something different. But I think what the leaders, the politicians, but especially, of course, Erdogan and the AKP, they should just, they are the people who can keep these people calm on the streets. So, you know, and after that, we are going to see what's going to happen. But they're not going to, you know, listen to anyone else but Erdogan, probably. I think it is a way to calm people down. And, you know, because there are people chanting on the streets, like, Allahu Akbar and Tekbir. So this is kind of scary, too. I think this is also what the women are mostly scared of.
Bonjour, Caracas. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, the Israeli Parliament has brought in controversial new legislation allowing impeachment on the grounds of incitement to violence, racism or support for terrorism. That's in just a moment.
Human rights group Amnesty International have called for an immediate investigation into civilian casualties caused by US-led airstrikes in Syria.
Human Rights Watch has called for an immediate halt to the practice of detaining child refugees in Greece.
And just how did the Mississippi Senate find itself haunted, yes, haunted, by a demon chipmunk? Well, we'll have more on that later.
The Israeli Parliament, or Knesset, has today passed a law enabling its members to impeach legislators deemed guilty of inciting violence, racism or supporting armed struggle against the state. The Association of Civil Rights in Israel have expressed concern over the new legislation, arguing that it, quote, harms the very building blocks of democracy, the right to freedom of expression, the right to vote and to be elected, and the right to representation. The Prime Minister Netanyahu said that the law would end what he described as the absurd situation whereby supporters of anti-Israeli terrorism could serve in Israel's parliament.
Joining me on the line now from Efrat in the West Bank is Dr. Ephraim Zuroff from the Simon Wiesenthal Centre. Thank you for talking to us, Dr. Zuroff. How do you respond to those who've said that this is an attack on democracy?
This law was passed because of some very unfortunate incidents which took place over the past year and involved a member of the Arab List called Hanin Zoabi. Ms. Zoabi likes nothing better than to get up in front of the Israeli Knesset and make the most outrageous, idiotic, and totally unfounded charges against the State of Israel and against the soldiers of the IDF, among them Muslims and Christians. And that's why this law was passed. In other words, this is a woman whose goal in life is to be a provocateur and to do everything possible to besmirch the state that's paying her salary.
Is democracy, though, not defined by its ability to allow all voices, however horrific they might be?
As I explained to you, freedom of speech is not the freedom to incite. Freedom of speech is not to defend terrorists. It's not the freedom to defend terror. And Ms. Zoabi, unfortunately, has been involved in that. And consequently, the Knesset sought a means to protect itself against the likes of Hanin Zoabi.
But just because...
Let me tell you something. Democracy, just wait a minute, okay? Democracy has not always succeeded in defending itself, okay? Hitler was also elected in a democratic election, okay? And democracy has not always been smart enough or innovative enough to defend itself. And sometimes you have to pass laws that might appear to limit freedom of speech, but that those accusations are based on a misunderstanding of what freedom of speech means.
But just because someone accuses someone else of inciting violence or of supporting terrorism, it doesn't necessarily make it so. I mean, how can it be that politicians are the only arbiters here? I mean, that surely is just a means for a governing majority to silence dissenting voices, or at least it could be used as a means for that.
First of all, I think that the elected officials of the State of Israel are in a position to be able to assess whether or not the accusations made against the state have any basis. Okay? And you have people in the Knesset of all different opinions, and they have a very lively debate in the Knesset. And I think that the if a situation is created in which there is a consensus of almost every single member of Knesset who wants to you know use this law, that is obviously a situation in which the law is called for.
And how do you respond to the idea that in a democracy there is already a mechanism for impeachment, if you like, for offending views, and that being elections?
Okay, first of all, you don't know what a member of Knesset will say once he's elected. And I don't know if people were aware of what she would say in the case of Khanin Zoabi. First of all, most of the people who elected her, I'm not so sure they don't agree with her, perhaps.
Should but, they not be I mean, represented
the
then?
The truth of the matter is she is really misrepresenting her constituents. Because I think it's a fair assumption to say that she's representing the Arab citizens of the state of Israel, okay? That she considers that her mandate, okay? And they're the ones who put her into office.
But if her voters...
But what she's doing is a tremendous disservice to her constituents, because the overwhelming majority of her constituents are law-abiding citizens of the state of Israel who don't want to arouse antagonism or hatred between Jews and Arabs. And that's precisely what Ms. Zoabi is doing. But she is doing it to please people not living in the state of Israel, but living outside the state of Israel and want to undermine the state of Israel. So, you know, the show is not to the benefit of her constituents, but rather to gain support and favor from forces in the Arab world who are dead set against the state of Israel.
But, I mean, there are those who would argue that the government itself are antagonistic.
This conversation is going nowhere, okay? I think I made clear to you what my opinion is. The fact that you don't agree with my opinion is your privilege.
My personal position is irrelevant
here. For 20 minutes, okay, saying the same thing over and over and over and over. I explained to you why I don't think this is a blow to democracy. I explained to you my view on freedom of speech, and that should suffice.
Well, perhaps we've reached an impasse. Thank you very much for talking to us, Dr. Zuroff.
Joining me now in the studio is Mick Napier of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Now, Mick, surely a government and democracy has to protect itself against a situation, as the Israeli Prime Minister has pointed out, whereby someone who supports terror against the State of Israel and its citizens could serve as a Member of Parliament.
Well, that guy you just heard is pretty special. First of all, who are the terrorists? The Israeli army has been butchering people in Gaza periodically for several years, has been condemned by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the United Nations, etc., etc., etc. Everybody except the State of Israel. And your speaker there said that Hanin Zoabi, a member of the Knesset, an elected representative, was besmirching the Israeli army and the Israeli state. She's only echoing faintly what's already been a consensus view pretty much around the world, that Israel's treatment of the Palestinian minority inside Israel, not just in the West Bank, has been shocking.
But if you have someone like Ms. Zoabi continually attacking Muslim and Christian soldiers of the Israeli army, should she be given a platform to do so?
Well, of course she should be given a platform to do so. It depends what this army's doing. This army has received condemnation by virtually every human rights body in the world. They have been deemed guilty, certainly guilty, of war crimes and very, very possibly crimes against humanity, which are the most serious category of crime in international law. So it's not easy to besmirch an army which butchered 550 children in Gaza in 2014. And inside the State of Israel, we have a state which really represents, where non-Jewish citizens are inferior to Jewish citizens from the day they are born to the day they die and can never achieve political equality. So, for example, the elected members of the Israeli Knesset, who represent, I think it's called the Joint List, but those who represent the Arab minority, can never be allowed by any Zionist party to form part of a coalition and therefore guarantee a majority, because such a in the Zionist political system, relying upon Arab votes for a majority against other Zionist parties is considered very, very illegitimate. So the inequality in the society reaches right up inside the Knesset itself.
These Arab MPs do have seats within the Knesset, and do you not think that the democratically elected Knesset should be allowed to have a democratic right to, in a sense, monitor itself?
Well, democracy is more than putting bits of paper in a ballot box. You can put bits of, I mean, in South Africa, people voted. There were separate lists, but everybody voted, a little remembered fact. And in Israel, certainly, very similar to, say, Northern Ireland in the past, which was very much based on the superiority of one group over another, everybody gets a vote. But the methods by which the Arab minority are disenfranchised are very, very clear. So, for example, many Arab villages, which are older than the state of Israel, still do not receive running water, electricity or basic services. They're called so-called unrecognised villages. Now, this could never happen to any Jewish settlement. So it's very clear, it was very clear, for example, to Desmond Tutu, an expert on South African apartheid, that compared to what the Palestinians are going through, it was a picnic, he said, in South Africa. So the world's experts recognise an apartheid system, and so do the Arab members of the Israeli Knesset.
And Dr. Zuraf said here that freedom of speech does not give freedom to incite or defend terror and violence. Do you think that Ms. Wahbi is doing that, that she's inciting terror and violence?
Well, he was pretty special, wasn't he? But look, what does incitement mean in the Zionist lexicon? For example, I don't know if it's actually been made a crime, but it was very, very seriously considered, that commemoration of the events of 1948, which led to the setting up of the State of Israel and a massive ethnic cleansing of its Palestinian citizens, 80% of them were driven out into refugee camps, that this was to be declared a crime. It was to be illegal to commemorate what Palestinians called the Nakba of 1948, the catastrophe. And in the Zionist lexicon, incitement means that people living in refugee camps who can see American or Russian settlers in their homes on a clear day, stolen from them, who say that they have the right to return to their homes, this is deemed to be incitement. If you oppose the Israeli massacres of Palestinians, this the Israeli government considers to be incitement. Incitement, I think, translates into a determination to recover their human rights. So that's what your previous speaker meant. He's got a huge skeleton in his cupboard.
And just finally, unfortunately, Dr. Zuroff is no longer on the line, but what would you say in response to his comments?
Well, I would say he's laughable. First of all, he's kind of handbagging the interviewer. The Israeli elite wish the Arab members of the Knesset to concede that Israel is a Jewish and a democratic state. Now, this is quite clearly to square a circle. It's to admit to something that's impossible. A state based upon the superiority, social and political, of one ethnic group over another cannot be a democracy. And Israeli scholars who've analysed it consider it not to be a democracy, or a sort of settler democracy. Just as whites in South Africa voted and blacks voted, but the whites were always dominant, anyone can vote in Israel, but the Jewish Zionist bloc is always dominant.
Well, Mick Napier, thank you very much for joining us in the studio today.
I hope I behaved better than your previous speaker.
Human rights group Amnesty International have today called for a prompt, independent and transparent investigation into the reports of hundreds of civilian casualties caused by airstrikes by the US-led coalition forces in Syria. The human rights group states that since June, more than 100 civilians are said to have been killed in suspected coalition strikes in the Manbij area of northern Syria, which is currently occupied by armed Daesh forces.
Apparently, many of the civilian casualties occur in residential areas, leading to Amnesty International stating that not enough has been done to prevent civilian deaths. US Central Command, CENTCOM, has stated that 11 strikes earlier this week were against Daesh tactical units, though accounts from local activists suggest that there have been at least 60 civilian casualties, though the true death toll is difficult to know, as according to media reports in the area, several civilians are still unaccounted for as the airstrikes levelled their clay homes.
Joining us on the line is Neil Sammons, Amnesty International's Syria researcher. Neil, do you think that there has been a breach of international law here that the coalition forces could have prevented civilian casualties?
Yeah, I think it's very likely that the scale of the number of civilians killed, which looks like 70 or more, possibly much higher in relation to what the likely military benefit was, looks disproportionately high. We don't have enough information on what the actual targets were which were hit, but if it was a vehicle with some ammunition, which appears to be the case at the moment, then clearly that is far inadequate for any kind of, as a potential military gain compared to the very large numbers of civilians killed.
And Amnesty have said that in the majority of cases in which civilian casualties have been credibly reported, the coalition has dismissed these claims. Now, is this because they don't have access to the information to prove there were civilian casualties, or is this an outright denial?
It's probably a bit of both. We think that they may be quite genuine when they say that they want to ensure that civilians aren't killed, and they do use at times very precise weaponry which does take out the targets they want. But there is very good information saying that many, many civilians have been killed, probably 500 or more over the last couple of years, and increasingly so. But in their own investigations, they rely primarily on what can be seen from the sky, like as they carry out the shots. And they tend to ignore images that are otherwise obtainable from Syrian human rights organizations and others of dead bodies and damage and destruction to civilian infrastructure. They don't have people on the ground almost all the time who might be able to assess it, but independent bodies such as ourselves who can look at these things would say that there have been hundreds and hundreds more civilian casualties from US-led strikes than they admit.
And other than trying to report on the civilian casualties, what else are Amnesty International and groups like yourselves doing to try and reach out to the coalition forces and see what can be done to try and prevent this?
Well, I mean, we have a kind of dialogue going on with like the main players in the coalition. We are finalising a memorandum to CENTCOM, who coordinate the US-led activities in Syria as well as in Iraq. Sadly, events in Syria often mean that this has been left to the side while we've carried out more immediate reactive work, but hopefully within a week or two we would have sent a memorandum of our concerns to the US-led authorities there, and would be happy to converse with them about our findings and recommendations.
Neil, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Pleasure, thank you.
The charity Human Rights Watch has called for an end to the practice of detaining child refugees in police cells for weeks, even months at a time in Greece. The Greek authorities regularly detain children seeking asylum who are travelling on their own in what Human Rights Watch describe as small, crowded, unsanitary police station cells.
Rebecca Riddle at Human Rights Watch said, quote, locking vulnerable children in cramped and dirty cells for weeks or months is never an acceptable alternative for kids who need and deserve care and protection. The Convention of the Rights of the Child, to which Greece is a party, says that children can only be detained as a last resort and for the shortest appropriate period. On top of that, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child concluded that detention cannot be justified solely on the basis of the child being unaccompanied or separated.
And finally, any member of the Mississippi House or Senate is entitled to demand that a bill be read aloud before a vote is taken on it, according to the state constitution. And that seems like a fairly fair rule, but it's often used as a filibuster tactic, filibustering being when people basically keep talking for so long that nothing can get done.
The state Supreme Court, though, is currently considering the constitutional status of Republican Speaker Philip Gunn's creative solution to the problem. That's after he introduced a special machine that reads the bill at super speed, so much that it's been dubbed the Demon Chipmunk.
And unfortunately, we don't actually have a clip of that. We hoped to be able to find one, but we weren't able to.
I was really looking forward to hearing kind of local taxation reports in chipmunk voice. I think it would make bills a much more enjoyable read, really.
On the upside, this story is of course, a lot less scary sounding than the headline. I thought there was an actual demon chipmunk haunting the Mississippi House.
Well, maybe there is, and we just don't know about it.
Or maybe we wrote that headline in a deceptive way to make it sound a little bit more scary. But if that doesn't happen, I'm sure that we'll be straight on it.
Is that you're offering to go and hunt down demon chipmunks?
Every good news organisation needs a demon chipmunk correspondent.
I look forward to sending you to far-flung parts of the world when demon chipmunks surface, Jack.
I look forward to that day too. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this evening. Don't forget that you can find out more about everything we were discussing and a whole lot more over at sputniknews.com.
And of course, you heard it all right here on Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Till tomorrow, from me, Carolyn
and
Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.